From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
As Congress moves forward on a $1.9 trillion COVID relief and stimulus package, a look at what else is buried in that legislation. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. On Monday, the House Budget Committee advanced this $1.9 trillion COVID bill that Joe Biden has called for. It is now heading to the House Rules Committee, but there's some reporting suggesting that a floor vote is expected by maybe Friday or maybe over the weekend. Yet in many places, I think there's been remarkably little debate about what actually is in this $1.9 trillion package. And Kim, you did a deep dive on this. Tell us what you found and maybe start with the ratio of direct COVID provisions to everything else.
Yeah, so this is the ruse, as it were, of this bill. $1.9 trillion. And all of it presented as a COVID relief bill. But when you really dig into all the different House committee bills, what you find is if you're looking for those provisions that really seem to be about COVID, you could probably, with a very, very generous definition of that, get to about $825 billion. And that breaks down kind of this way. There's about $75 billion for vaccinations and treatments and testing and medical supplies. There's also about $19 billion for public health, another $6 billion for Indian health services, some money for mental health. And then you get into, you know, $7 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program, which is supposed to help small businesses. And, you know, another $15 billion for injury disaster loans and $26 billion for restaurants and bars, et cetera. And then the bulk of that $825 billion is that $413 billion in checks that Democrats intend to send to individual households. You know, I think a lot of people would maybe argue that second, that last provision isn't necessarily COVID relief, since one of the complaints about that is that a lot of it's going to go to people who are fully employed and haven't had any problem in terms of unemployment with COVID. But that's kind of how you get to that money there. Oh, and the bill's unemployment provisions as well, too, which is about $250 billion for those enhanced unemployment benefits. So $825 billion out of $1.9 trillion.
But by that measure, Bill, then there's more non-COVID stuff in this legislation than there are provisions spending that are directly related to ending the pandemic and helping people get through it.
Absolutely. That's part of the problem. The majority of the spending in this bill is not directly related. I think generously you may get $800 million if you're very generous with your with your definitions of what's related to COVID. But again, that's how legislatures function. You know, they're not going to let an opportunity for spending to get away from them. And, you know, people ask fewer questions when the top line item is COVID relief, right? So in the name of this, you can sneak a lot of other things through.
So one of the things in the other bucket, as we're categorizing it here, is this $350 billion for states and local governments. And Kim, one of the issues there, the Journal has an editorial that mentions this, is that money, some of that money is going to be allocated with a different funding formula than last time. Can you explain that and give people a sense of what the implications of that is?
Yeah. So the last time around, when we gave out some money to the states, it was largely allocated the way they did it on the formula was that everybody kind of got a set small amount, a couple of billion dollars equally. And then they apportioned the rest of it essentially on a state population, and that makes some sense, right? If you are tiny Vermont, you shouldn't be getting the same dollar figure as giant New York. This time around, there's going to be that same little provision where everyone gets kind of an equal lump sum. It's quite small. And then the rest of it is going to be allocated based on average unemployment over the 3-month period ending in December. And the perverse aspect of this is that what it means is that more of the money, the vast majority of the money, is going to go to states like New York or California that have very high unemployment rates because they have crushed their businesses with overly restrictive lockdowns. While states like South Dakota, which only has a 3% unemployment rate in December, is going to get penalized for staying open. And that was done very deliberately by Democrats. They, in fact, wanted this money to be funneled to blue states, and this was a pretty easy way to do it.
And I mean, I suppose the argument there is that you should send the money where the unemployment is the highest and it's needed. But it does seem to cut any link between the policy choices that led to that and the funding. And then, of course, the bigger question here of is why are we sending this huge tranche of money out when there are headlines talking about a lot of these states now having unexpected budget surpluses? And you can just go into Google News and type in budget surplus. I did that this morning, and here's a couple headlines. The Associated Press: California governor's budget booms despite pandemic problems. Here's one from Fox Business: Utah estimates $1.5 billion budget surplus after year of COVID. DC gets an unexpected surprise, a big budget surplus. And then here's one from NJ.com. NJ budget could be surprisingly flush with cash. What will Murphy do with all the money? So, Bill, I mean, the problem is, not that it's a problem, it's a good problem to have, is they're asking, what is Governor Murphy in New Jersey going to do with all this extra money that's come in unexpectedly? So why would we be, why would the federal government would be shoveling more of it his way?
Well, because I think it's more than just the budget. New Jersey, as you know, suffers from a huge pension crisis and a lot of long-term challenges as a lot of the more affluent residents flee the state, and you have other people coming in, but they're generally not as affluent, so therefore not as big a factor as taxpayers as the previous population. You know, your point is exactly right on the logic, like, of sending this money to these states with the highest unemployment. Let's go where the hurt is the greatest. The problem with that is that it's subsidizing very bad policy choices, right? And more than that, you know, because it's federal dollars, you're basically saying that people in Florida, where they manage pretty well, have to subsidize the people, send their money to the people of New Jersey who haven't. And that's one of the problems. And so they're aiming for all things. You know, one sub-example of what you gave with the money and with Kim is that on the school funding, for example, I mean, I believe the estimate is between $53 and $63 billion that's still unspent from the CARES Act. So it's just this opportunity. They see the gravy train and they want to, you know, fill up their pots with it.
And Bill raises the issue of the school funding, and there's some interesting projections, Kim. I think there's about $129 billion of school funding in this COVID package. And there are some projections about how quickly or not quickly, as the case may be, that money would actually be spent.
Yes, in part because schools, and that counts both elementary and second schools and higher education, schools were sent an estimated $113 billion last year via the other big funding bills that were passed. And the CBO notes that, quote, most of those funds remain to be spent, end quote, meaning they haven't even been used. So in its own projections, it estimates that 95% of this new money, that's $129 billion for K through 12 and another $40 billion for higher education, 95% of that will be spent from the years 2022 through 2028. That is, at least we hope, when the pandemic is well over. So the way I think you look at that lump in this package is it's basically a kind of payout gift to public schools and teachers unions for the next decade.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. But that raises, I mean, the same question, Bill. What are we doing here if this bill has money that is not going to be spent by these schools? It's projected until 2028. And it calls to mind, I mean, this is the problem of getting into a crisis and passing a bill with tons of line items and big line items in them and expecting that that is all going to be used in the crisis. I mean, it calls to mind after the stimulus in 2008, 2009, President Obama's admission bill that that shovel ready jobs was the mantra, that right. Shovel ready wasn't quite as shovel ready as we expected it would be.
Yes, exactly. Look, this is a problem with federal spending. And again, when you do it in under an emergency auspices, you know, that people really need help now, and a lot of people do need help, that you ask fewer questions and you don't look at the fine print, you know, as Kim pointed out, some of the formulas that determine where the money's going to go. It's just a massive federal subsidy to these public school systems. And you know, it serves no other purpose. That's what they want. And again, it sort of evades the real point, you know, behind this bill. The real stimulus is to get the economy working again. Think of how many people, you know, have lost their job, how many businesses have shuttered for good and so forth. There's a lot of people that could go right back to work if we opened up, and it's coming, but it's coming very slowly for a lot of people. And when we pass things like minimum wage or different unemployment subsidies, we're just encouraging people not to go back to work. And it just seems like it's too subtle a distinction for Congress to appreciate.
Another line item in this bill, Kim, is billions of dollars for these multi-employer pension plans. What's the story with that?
Well, these are plans that are jointly sponsored or managed, rather, by employers and unions. They have over the years been chronically underfunded, and that is usually because you get the lobbyists and the union folks who demand that Congress sort of water down federal standards and change accounting rules so that they don't have to put as much into them. And so they're always behind. They're always on the verge of collapse. Democrats have been demanding a rescue for them for years, as long as I've been writing about this stuff. So they managed to do it here. The bill includes about $86 billion to underwrite what the estimate is probably about 185 or so multi-employer pension plans. It sort of depends on the simulation you run and how the grants end up going out the door. It could help as many as 500 in some scenarios, but they felt the average was that about 185 would get basically rescued by this. The government's going to top up their funds. But the problem with that, obviously, is it allows them to continue overpromising and underfunding the plans. And, you know, one of the things that's a little concerning is that it also, this bill has a provision that would allow single employer pension plans to potentially start also watering down some of their rules for funding, too.
So, I mean, two issues there. One, Bill, is, I mean, again, I have a hard time seeing how this is related to coronavirus relief or stimulus, getting the economy going again. But the other is, I mean, maybe it's worth a debate in Congress, a real debate, not sticking this thing in the back of, you know, a big, huge stimulus package that is, you know, Democrats are moving really quickly to pass, but a real debate about what to do with these pension plans. And, you know, also important, how to make sure that in 25 or 30 years, we're not stuck with the same problem.
Absolutely, Kyle. I mean, this is the problem with doing large bills these ways, that the individual items, which are quite significant and large in themselves, if they were standalones, just don't get the attention that they ought to get. We mentioned, I think, a little earlier, the minimum wage. I mean, to me, one of the most interesting things is whether the Senate parliamentarian will allow a minimum wage provision to be included in the reconciliation bill, because the parliamentarian decides what's relevant and what's not. And I think by any honest accounting, it's not relevant under the current rules, that it really must be directly relevant to the budget and not just an ancillary budget issue. So we'll see. It seems to me that the Democrats don't want to start out by crossing the parliamentarian. I think they will if they have to, but this will be a big test, because if we're going to go this route and then we're just going to throw out the rules that are designed to mitigate the downside of going this route, I think we're just going to have no restraint at all.
On the minimum wage, that's an interesting conversation, and Politico is reporting that on Wednesday, Democrats and Republicans will both make their case to the Senate parliamentarian. But what's notable about that timing, Kim, is if the House is going to vote on Friday, let's say, the House might not know what the parliamentarian is going to rule when the House moves its bill. And so it could set up a tough vote for particularly Democrats in red states that don't have costs of living that have low costs of living, where a $15 minimum wage could bite some small businesses.
Yeah, now you're getting into this is a question in terms of the politics of parliamentary procedure, in essence. But I mean, most Democrats, House Democrats, had this fight over the minimum wage 2 years ago. And the moderates, the ones that you're mentioning that are in some of those red states, won some provisions that they felt at least gave them enough cover to vote for a hike in the minimum wage, meaning that it would come up more gradually over a period of years. They'd get a report back at some point to allow Congress to say, hey, how is this going? I don't think it was still very, it's a terrible idea for the economy, but that was how Nancy Pelosi got it through last time around. And the provision they have in this bill is similar. So I see most House Democrats voting for it. It's a little bit more complicated because of coronavirus this time and the hurt that a lot of small businesses are in, but I still see that happening. The question of the parliamentarian is, if the Senate parliamentarian has not yet ruled, or I should say, if the Senate parliamentarian does rule before that House vote, the House is in this weird situation where the Senate has already said this is not allowed to be in a Senate package. Is Nancy Pelosi going to make her members go out and essentially vote for a provision that would overrule the Senate parliamentarian or put senators in a tough position in the Senate, just kind of force this issue? There are some Democrats that want Democrats to overrule the parliamentarian. That would be unprecedented. It would essentially be the equivalent of breaking the filibuster. That's why you've seen Joe Manchin from West Virginia say he wouldn't do it. But there's going to be a lot of pressure on this issue, depending on what the parliamentarian says.
But it's interesting, if the parliamentarian says this is allowed, or if they Senate Democrats move to overrule the parliamentarian are successful, you still have this separate problem of these two senators, in particular, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who is saying he won't vote for $15. And he drew a little bit of a line, Bill, on Monday. And here's what he said. He said, $11 is the right place to be. Throwing $15 out there right now just makes it very difficult in rural America, unquote. So, it's like we have stacked problems here for this $15 minimum wage. The first is the parliamentarian. Can you even do it through this bill? And then the second is whether they can get enough votes to get to $15 if they need to get Joe Manchin.
Right. No, this is, I think, one of the big dilemmas of the early Biden administration, how they're going to handle this. Look, if the Senate parliamentarian allows it in the bill, it takes a lot of pressure off. It's a big win for the Biden administration, because then people have less of a substantive argument that this doesn't belong in the reconciliation process. Joe Manchin's interesting because as far as I read him, as you point out with his $11, he's not taking the line that I'm not going to vote for an increase in the minimum wage. His argument is more about where they set that price, because for a state like his that is not as expensive and so forth as, say, New York or Los Angeles, more rural, the higher the wage, the far more the burden on local employers and so forth. So he seems to want to just bring them down to a price that he can afford, that he thinks West Virginia can afford. Kyrsten Sinema is more interesting. As far as I read her, she's made more of the principled stand that this doesn't belong in the budget. So if the parliamentarian takes that issue away, takes the process issue that this is allowable, then you have to see if people are really going to continue to vote against it. I mean, the Democrats could conceivably win that, but that may cost them other votes. So I think this is a big issue, and it's going to tell us, you know, whether institutions are just going to roll over and start, ignoring all the rules and so forth, or, you know, whether we're going to have some order. My impression is that the Biden administration would very much like not to have the confrontation with the Senate parliamentarian, but there may be no choice. If the parliamentarian rules against it, the progressives in the Democratic Party are still going to be pushing hard to include a minimum wage, which then might cost them a few votes.
A couple of last points about what's in this bill. First, there's, as usual, there's some odds and ends stuffed into cracks here and there. There's money for Amtrak. There's money for a bridge in New York. And Kim, that made me chuckle a little bit because it made me think of our conversation last week about earmarks.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. You couldn't find a lot that were really blatant in this bill. I think because the writers were aware that it would undermine their claim that this was COVID relief and it would just be incredibly obvious. But nonetheless, there is this one glaring example of a clear earmark to the what's called the Seaway International Bridge. It's in upstate New York. And it just happens to be a big pet project of none other than Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. And you can go back and just throw it into Google, and it's quite funny. This is partly operated by a group called the St. Lawrence Seaway Development Corporation. Schumer is all about that. All through it's like Schumer and Gillibrand announced $40 million in federal funding, and Schumer releases $6 million, awarded to St. Lawrence Seaway. So this is clearly one of his big priorities, and lo and behold, there is a lot of money in the bill for that project.
And then finally, there's also a bit of a tax change in the legislation, and it's projected to raise about $22 billion over a decade. And it has to do, I've looked into this a little bit, it has to do with the way that multinational companies, when they do their taxes, how they allocate their interest expenses from the parent company to foreign earnings. And the details are a little bit complicated. You can go to the Tax Foundation and check those out if you want. But the gist here is that there was a change made in 2004 to align the tax system a little bit more with economic realities, as I understand it. And that provision only took effect this year because it was repeatedly delayed by Congress's looking for a little bit of cash that they could use to pay for something else. And here we are again. And Bill, this is just, it's buried in the bill, but it's a $22 billion tax increase on the private economy over the course of a decade. And nobody really is talking about it.
Right. And it's one that, you would think the Biden administration would be particularly sensitive to because it has to do with multinationals and how they allocate their costs and where they are. And, you know, it's just one more thing that makes the U.S. Less appealing to people that want to set up their companies here that are multinational companies. So, of course, they don't want to talk about it. But are we surprised that in a $1.9 trillion-dollar bill. There are hidden costs and taxes in it. It's, you know, it's par for the cost. And the problem is, I think even when, it, you know, if this all goes through, no one's going to really see this tax, right? It's going to be a, it's going to be paid by multinationals, and it may be paid in different ways. One by actually writing a check for higher taxes to the government, another by deciding to relocate or something. It's, you know, it's again, it's the problem of government spending, that the so-called benefits are generally right up front. You know, this group will get this check, this state will get this amount of money, but the price is the price of that, the costs, which are real, are often hidden.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.